Hello, everybody. Bill Buckmaster with you, along with my buddy John, engineering and producing our program. On the other side of the glass, we welcome you to the Buckmaster Show. It is Monday. It's April 24th, 2023. Our show in our 13th year broadcasting from the Green Things Zocalo Village Studio on the campus of Bustos Media Tucson. Our radio station, 1030 KVOI, Tucson's voice for worldwide live listening. My website is buckmastershow.com. We have the live feed for the program. Our live line, when we do our telephone interviews, that is presented by Rincon Ventures, Real Estate and Property Management. It's time for the Monday One-on-One, presented by Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing. Family-owned and run since 1985, Moe specializes in custom frame mirrors. We have a couple of them in our home. Beautiful things. Moe is a fantastic photographer. He's got art available there at the gallery. And, of course, where they excel, picture framing. Now, after you get your items framed, if you don't want to get up on the ladder, make sure that the piece is on the wall the way you want it to be, ask Mo to come out and they will take care of that. They call that hanging services and hanging systems. Mo's Gallery and Fine Framing, Fort Lowell and Dodge, and their website is mosgallery.com. This week's one-on-one interview is with Dr. Beth Plummer. Dr. Plummer, the first holder of the Susan C. Carent Nunn Chair in Reformation and Early Modern European History in the Division for Late Medieval and Reformation Studies at the University of Arizona. With her research partners, Dr. Plummer is creating a database of shared churches, a project supported by a collaborative research grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities. During the 16th century, religious reform movements and global colonization brought new Christian denominations into regular contact, resulting in churches shared by more than one faith in many villages, towns, and cities across Europe. So the overarching question that we will put to Dr. Plummer is, how do people of different religions live together in peace? Dr. Plummer, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Bill. It's a pleasure.
This is a fascinating idea, this whole idea of shared, in this case, what you're working on, shared sacred spaces. Mm-hmm. How did this come about, this project?
Well, the project itself came about because three people got seated at the same table at a restaurant during a conference. It's one of those circumstances that you get talking about your research, and we turned out to have very similar things that we had been learning about how churches worked, how people were using space, how people were using devotional objects. And we decided at the end of the lovely dinner that we would like to do something about this. We would wanted to do some kind of digital project. This was in 2015.
And that was in 2015, as you say, and now this has grown. Mm-hmm. And tell me and tell our listeners about this database and how many areas are we talking about?
The database started out of a couple of our databases that we just had names of churches. We hadn't even tried to figure out where all of them were and which exact church. And so right now we have a list of about 1,060 churches that we've identified in primarily the Holy Roman Empire. But some of our churches, they go as far as Russia, over into the Netherlands and the Low Countries, down into northern Italy. France has quite a number of them, all the way to the east, Poland. And we know that there are a lot more. We just have started in Central Europe and have been moving out and trying to figure out where these shared churches exist.
What would the time frame be? What are we talking about?
Well, for the project, our time frame is from about 1550 to about 1800. And there's reasons for that. Mm-hmm. But they don't start in 1550, nor do they end in 1800.
Yeah, because you've actually discovered there are still some of these shared sacred spaces.
And there were new ones that were developed after that. So there are churches that have existed since the 16th or 17th century as shared spaces. So that there are Catholic and Lutheran communities, there are Lutheran and Reformed communities, and there are other groups that have shared spaces for 400 years, but there's also new ones that were developed in the 17th century, in the 18th century, and even into the modern day. There's communities, I found one in northern Germany, where the Catholic community kept getting smaller and smaller, and they kept having to travel to faraway communities mm-hmm, to mm-hmm. go to church, and finally the local Protestant church said that was silly. Why don't we just share this space? And that was done in the 80s.
The space, this was sort of a, depending on, well, I guess even at the very beginning, the reason that these people came together, it was sort of like a community town hall, right? I mean, this was a common area where people could gather. And is that kind of the way, when we talk about shared churches, how are we defining that?
The shared churches themselves, a lot of the communities that we're looking at are quite rural. They're very small. Mm-hmm. They may not have more than 100 people that live in the community. And the church was the place where everybody gathered for everything. It's where elections happened. It's where economic discussions happened. That was their shared space. And when the Reformation came along, it meant that some of the members of the community would have had to have left that space where everything got talked about, mm-hmm. Where all sorts of community identity happened. And so some communities just continued to worship together. They might have brought in another person, another clergy, allowed them to work. They might just have agreed to continue doing what they were doing in there.
That's fascinating. So you're saying there was this collaboration, right, with the Reformation, where people were leaving the Catholic Church, mm-hmm. the Roman Catholic Church, and they were going off to a Reformed form of Christianity, but still coming back to a shared space.
Yes, in a lot of communities, it took a lot of time for people to sort out what that meant,
right.
Just because the Reformation happened didn't mean that everybody suddenly changed all their things that they did. So in the 16th century, it's very hard to even find a shared church, in the sense that people didn't have defined religious identities. But by the 17th century, and certainly by the 18th century, people did have defined confessional or denominational groups that were set up. And in those moments of transition, there was a choice that communities had to make, but also choices that external people made for them. So there were oftentimes treaties that said that gave a group in a community the right to use the church, because after all, they had helped build it. Mm-hmm. There were financial interests in it, and so mm-hmm. why couldn't they continue to use it? And so for all sorts of reasons, and that's part of what we're exploring, is how did these communities develop these shared spaces.
We're speaking with Dr. Beth Plummer from the University of Arizona about her really interesting project. Right now, it's a database that is focused on Europe about shared churches. But Dr. Plummer, we've all heard that there are churches of all sorts of denominations in the United States and Canada that are closing. These churches have been the centerpiece of many small towns, mm-hmm. and they can't find clergy. There are not enough people attending, parishioners. So we're seeing this shared church movement in this country, aren't we?
Yes, and not only in this country, but across the world. There's mm-hmm. actually a global shared churches movement mm-hmm. to mm-hmm. some degree. And there's a lot of philosophical discussion. There's a lot of discussion about the architecture. There's a lot of discussion on whether these communities can actually function or not. How do you set up a devotional space that doesn't antagonize the group that you're sharing it with. And so there's one church that's being built in Berlin. They haven't gotten very far, which is an attempt to bring together a Jewish congregation, Muslim congregation, and a Christian congregation. It's to be the one church that they could all share in that location.
Interesting.
And this is not...
One stop.
One place.
One place.
Where people could try to agree on certain things, come up with some kind of solution. But architects are having trouble building it because how do you do that? Mm-hmm. And so it's a common architectural problem that happens in hospitals, in airports, and in other locations where you see shared religious spaces. There's always a place of worship in a place like a hospital.
Yeah.
But that is not a space that's defined by a specific group.
So it gets back to kind of that fundamental overreaching, overarching question, how do people of different religions gather and then live together in peace? So we're going to pause right here, Dr. Plummer, but it's very interesting. Dr. Beth Plummer, our Monday one-on-one guest, we're going to talk after the break about this whole concept of space. I'm not talking about outer space. I'm talking about your space, the space that all of us occupy every day and what that means. Right now, though, I want to talk about my favorite bakery in town, Mona's Danish Bakery, home of the Danish Kringle, northeast corner of Swan and Sunrise. We were up at Mona's yesterday, picked up a couple of outstanding croissants. The almond croissants specifically are wonderful. And I had one this morning. It was good the next day. Mona'sDanishBakery.com is their website. They do take Monday off, well-deserved day off. Tuesday through Saturday, they'd open at 6:30, Sunday, 7 o'clock in the morning. My advice, get there early for the best selection. More with Dr. Beth Plummer on our Monday one-on-one right after this. Family-owned Jam Culinary Concepts and its family of restaurants has you covered for your special event. Jam caters anytime, anywhere, any size group, and any type of cuisine. Vero Amore, authentic Neapolitan pizza, and Noble Hops. Craft beer and fine fare are synonymous with quality. Call 954-1468 or log on to jamculinaryconcepts.com.
The Regional Transportation Authority's 20-year plan includes roadway, transit, pedestrian, bicycle, and many other transportation improvements across the region. Pima County voters approved the plan in 2006, and the RTA is working with the Citizens Advisory Committee to prepare and present a new draft plan as early as 2023 for public review. Learn more about the process at rtanext.com.
Buckmaster Show listeners know that I'm passionate about travel. When I'm ready to take off on a new adventure, my air travel begins and ends at Tucson International Airport. TUS is nonstop for our community and Southern Arizona. So remember, to fly local, fly Tucson. Tucson International is nonstop for Tucson. More at flytucson.com.
Are you happy with the news you get? While not all news is good news, you know good reporting when you see it. Check TucsonSentinel.com every day for breaking news and investigative reports. Have your say in the comments. It's all in TucsonSentinel.com, your local, independent, nonprofit news. You can rely on TucsonSentinel.com for solid reporting about immigration, Tucson and Pima politics, everything from the border to baseball. It's independent news without the spin. TucsonSentinel.com. We are watching Tucson.
This is Bill Buckmaster urging my listeners to join me in becoming a member of the Reed Park Zoo, one of America's top zoos and home to more than 300 animals from all over the world. When you become a zoo member, you receive free daytime admission, discounts on special events and education programs, and so much more. Find out more about zoo membership and everything you need to know about your zoo visit, reedparkzoo.org.
Have you always wanted to cruise to Alaska? If that's the case, then you'll only see the tip of the iceberg. At Bon Voyage Travel, we can package the full Alaska experience with a cruise tour. Journey to Denali National Park on glass-domed rail cars. Tour the tundra wilderness and see the northern lights with an expert guide. And of course, relax on your cruise as you enjoy the glaciers up close and personal. Go to bvtravel.com today. Bon Voyage Travel, your Alaska experts.
This is Kate Delaney. Tune in later tonight as we talk about everything that happened throughout your day. Tonight at 10 on 1030 KVOI, The Voice.
Welcome back. It is the Buckmaster Show, part two of our Monday one-on-one presented by our friends at Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing, located right next to Copenhagen at Fort Lowell and Dodge, and their website's looking really good. They've revised it. And they are offering some really beautiful items for sale at mosgallery.com. This week's Monday one-on-one, Dr. Beth Plummer is with us. Dr. Plummer is the first holder of the Susan C. Carent Nunn Chair in Reformation and Early Modern European History in the Division for Late Medieval and Reformation Studies at the University of Arizona. And she's been talking with us about this database that they have been putting together of shared churches in Europe. And I think, Dr. Plummer, you said right now you were up to about 1,000 spaces. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting, this goes back like to the Holy Roman Empire, but there are still some of these shared spaces that are thriving today. How many would you get? Several dozen, correct?
Oh, yes, definitely. In Germany, there's at least 60, I think 65. Mm-hmm. France, there's another 50. And these are ones that have survived for centuries. In fact, in Bavaria, because one area is outside of Nuremberg, around Amberg, but in Bavaria, they have a shared churches of the year. So
what?
One of these churches they choose every year as the best shared church in the community.
Huh. And you had mentioned in part one about this really interesting project, and it has been slow to get off the ground because, as folks can imagine, there are a lot of considerations architecturally about what should this shared church look like that would actually bring together Judaism, Muslim, Christian, the Catholic, all in one space.
Mm-hmm.
And it's let's say it's having growing pains, right?
Well, it certainly has a lot of discussions that they have to make sure everybody can cooperate and share the space.
But it is a concept for the future that really people are talking about. And it's not just when it comes to churches, but you recently put together, well, I think you had about 70 scholars from all over the world that came to the University of Arizona, and the topic was space.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something, and we're not talking about outer space. We're talking about the space we all occupy. Right now, you're in my space. This studio is kind of, it's Bill's space from noon to one. But when I leave, it will be someone else's space. But the whole idea of space is fascinating.
Yeah, so the conference, we wanted to talk a little bit about a more theoretical aspect of space, because the sharing, not just the sharing churches space, but also any kind of sharing of space is fascinating. It's one way to think about how people interact, but not just people. How do humans interact with animals in mm-hmm. a space?
Mm-hmm.
And what's the experience of those different beings in a space. What is an object? How does an object in a space change the dynamics of that space? Because it may mean one thing to one person and another thing to another person. Even something like pregnancy is sharing spaces of mm-hmm. one sort or another. Mm-hmm. You share houses, you mm-hmm. share apartments, you share all sorts of things. Even letter collections are a kind of sharing, because it's sharing of intellectual and personal information as it crosses space. Mm-hmm. Doors can delineate space. Walls can delineate space. But there's other things that change how far a space is that belongs to you. So how far you can walk or how far you can drive can change the space. And your experience of that space can be quite different from the person next to you.
Like, I have a concept of you sitting across from mm-hmm. me. This is my space, the studio, but you have a different concept
as
being
as
the
a guest
in this space, and that just brings all sorts of different things up, doesn't it?
It does. And whether you're talking about space, which is socially constructed, or place, which this place doesn't change, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. but the space may change mm-hmm. at different times.
What have we learned so far getting back to the Shared Churches Project? What would you like to share with our listeners about what you've learned and what the team has learned?
We have learned that it's much more complicated. It's not a simple dichotomy of sharing. Some communities did quite well with the sharing of spaces, and other ones did not. And we're trying to understand when people came into conflict, what could have triggered that conflict, and whether it was just a natural outgrowth. So this comes into questions of tolerance and intolerance. And tolerance and intolerance can be triggered by things that are surprising. So one of the main things that triggered the most violent conflicts in communities was sound, the sound of bells, the
wow.
sound of people talking, the sound of people singing, which oftentimes transgressed the space that they were in.
Hmm. Let's talk about the Jewish community in Europe. Mm-hmm. You're kind of been cataloging that along with the database. What have you found out there?
What I've found out as I've gone through is that in many of the churches, there were other groups that also lived in the community. So trying to understand if there was some kind of correlation between the existence of a Jewish community, mm-hmm. Whether the community was more willing to accept another difference in communities. It's hard to draw a complete parallel, but there seemed to be, at least in the area that I've been looking at most recently, there seemed to be a large number of fairly early Jewish communities and small groups of families that moved into this.
And what's really sad is you were telling me before we went on that before World War II mm-hmm. in Germany, it was not uncommon that there would be shared churches in Germany with Jewish people and Christians.
There were occasionally.
I
had an instance where because of a military battle that had happened in this community, the synagogue or mm-hmm. the place where
yes.
the Jewish community was worshiping was destroyed. Mm-hmm. And the Christian community, or at least the Protestant community in this particular case, allowed the Jewish community to worship in the church as a kind of hospitality or a community feeling about that. That wasn't every day, but it did happen. The same with refugees.
Gives you some hope.
It does give you me hope.
At least there was that kind of a grain of cooperation.
There
and,
was.
Collaboration. What about your plans? You're going to be on the road.
Yes. So we're going to spend, this is our first summer of the mm-hmm. project, and we're going to be in Germany for 6 weeks on the road, visiting these communities, because mm-hmm. it's one thing to look at them in books, and it's one thing to look at them in their practical space. So we will be going both to archives and to the churches themselves. We've picked out about 25 of them that we'll be looking at. We'll be going into the spaces, trying to figure out, did they have two doors to get into the space? Where did each of the groups worship? Do we still have any kind of visual and physical evidence of the sharing of this space? And so we'll be cataloging objects and space.
Both your parents had careers, great careers, scientists. Why did you go along this particular path?
Well, my parents will have divergent opinions on what happened. I blame them because when I was a child, my dad was in the Air Force, and we were stationed over in Europe, and we went all over the place. They took us to museums.
Sure.
I remember going to Rome and running all over the Forum and all of that sort of thing. So then they did that the whole time I was growing up. So it's perhaps not surprising that I became a historian and my sister became an art historian. She's a director now of the Stowe Museum in Hartford, Connecticut.
Wonderful. So you both, the girls, the girls were exposed to museums and
music,
and art. Yeah, it's wonderful. Dr. Plummer, all the best to you and your research, and we've really enjoyed our time together.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Sharing our space here together. I appreciate it very much. Thank you. Our Monday One-on-One is presented by Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing. Moe and the team located at Fort Lowell and Dodge. Their website is moesgallery.com. We're going to take a break right here. The Buckmaster Show continues on a Monday afternoon. Be right back.
Take out authentic Neapolitan wood-fired pizza at Vero Amore, where every flavorful pizza, pasta, and panini are homemade using the finest local and imported ingredients. Vero Amore, Plaza Palomino at Swan and Fort Lowell, and on Dove Mountain in Marana, plus a full catering menu and mobile pizza truck for parties and events. Vero Amore, on the web at veroamorepizza.com.
The Friends of Pima Animal Care Center is the nonprofit partner to our Pima County Animal Shelter. We grant critically needed resources to PACC so that it can continue the amazing life-saving progress it has made in recent years. Your generosity helps us find homes for abused, neglected, and abandoned animals at PAC. Learn how you can help at friendsofpacc.org.
Cushman & Wakefield PICOR is Tucson's leading independently owned full-service commercial real estate company. Founded in 1985, Cushman & Wakefield PICOR offers leasing, sales, and property management for industrial office, medical, retail, land, and investment properties in Tucson and Sonora, Mexico. Visit our website at PICOR.com for the latest news from Tucson's commercial real estate sector. That's PICOR.com. Call us at 748-7100.
Hi, this is Irene Coppola, President and CEO of the Better Business Bureau serving Southern Arizona. The BBB sets the standards for marketplace trust by engaging with and educating consumers and businesses. The BBB is the resource to turn to for the objective, unbiased information on businesses offering national and local consumer services online and in person. Learn more about the many services offered by the Better Business Bureau at bbb.org.
Family owned and run since 1985, Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing is the gold standard for quality and professionalism for picture framing, custom frame mirrors, art for your walls, and hanging and lighting solutions. Come in for your design session or set it up electronically.
Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing, Fort Lowell and Dodge, and now doing e-commerce at moesgallery.com.
The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun cover two of Arizona's most desirable communities. The newspapers reach more than 75% of the communities each week, with a combined population of more than 50,000. The Green Valley News also publishes a dozen magazines each year, and both newspapers publish up-to-the-minute local news online at gvnews.com. The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun, it's all right here.
Welcome back. It is the Buckmaster Show on this Monday afternoon. One of our great sponsors, we are in the Green Things Zocalo Village Studio. Green Things, perfect time of year to get all of your spring planting done. 3384 East River Road by the Rito River, just west of the Brandy Fenton Park. They're open daily in their 53rd year of business. Their website is greenthingsaz.com. Their sister business on their 13-acre site, Zocalo Village. ZocaloVillage.com is the website, and they have some beautiful merchandise from Latin America. They've got Talavera pottery from Mexico that is, they've got the largest selection in Arizona, and really great price point as well there. So a lot going on this time of year, especially over at Green Things, just west of the Brandy Fenton Park. When we do our telephone interviews, the live line is sponsored by Rincon Ventures Real Estate and Property Management. Let's welcome back to the show the District 2 Democrat on the Pima County Board of Supervisors, the 5-member board, Dr. Matt Hines. Dr. Hines, how are you?
Doing well, Bill. How are you doing?
Doing well. Thanks for asking. I know everybody would like to say, oh, COVID, that's not a problem anymore. Yeah, we're in the fourth year, but I have a friend that got back from Amsterdam, was on visiting over there and came back. She had been completely, you know, boosted and everything, and got a really, really bad case of COVID. So there's no rhyme or reason that saying just because, oh yeah, I had one bout of COVID, it was mild, that there's no guarantee, Dr. Matt Hines, that the second bout will be mild as well.
That's right. That's right. And look, COVID is not going anywhere. What we're talking about with the, you know, end of the public health emergency, you know, yeah, that is the numbers we were seeing, you know, a year and a half, 2 years ago. That's what we're talking about. It's not the level of public health crisis that it was previously. I think we can all agree with that. But there are patients in my hospital with COVID that are very, very sick and are struggling for their lives still. And in many cases, they have, just like your friend, they have been vaccinated fully and boosted the appropriate number of times. And, you know, we can't predict necessarily who's going to do real well or not, you know.
Yeah, and I have booked we'll be traveling internationally on vacation. I'll be gone for a couple of weeks in May. Before we go, I'm eligible, so I'm going to take advantage of this second booster, which will be available and is available right now. I've booked that for this week, and I figure, well, a little bit of prevention may go a long way, Dr. Hines. So I'm gonna be cautious, yes, but you just never know.
That's right. And look, I've been traveling to visit my family, my father, who is back in Michigan and is going to be having a heart valve procedure very soon. So I've been traveling a little more than usual for myself, and I am I'm masking, sometimes double masking, as if I'm going into a COVID patient's room. When I am in the airport, waiting in the little jetway, and then getting onto the plane, and until wheels up, the plane is not a very safe place. You're stagnating and kind of breathing everyone else's stuff, and almost nobody wears masks. So my advice for you and anyone else, if you're willing to, I would mask as you're with crowds in the airport and waiting to get on the plane, and don't take that mask or masks off until that very high quality rapid circulation ventilation system that our planes do have with excellent filters is fully in force. Then I'm comfortable taking my mask off for the duration of the flight until landing.
Well, that is very good advice, and it's advice that we have heard before on this program being echoed by our friend Jeff Lattice, who just recently retired.
Yeah.
Jeff recently retired from JetBlue. He was a captain, senior captain there, but mandatory retirement at 65. But Jeff is our aviation contributor to this show. And yeah, he's talked about the fact that wear the mask until it is wheels up and the air is recirculating, and the air is being recirculated with outdoor air being, you know, filtered every 2 to 3 minutes on board.
Yeah, that's safe. That's very safe.
So, and
I agree.
Yeah, and before we leave this discussion, which I think is pretty darn important still about COVID, there is a new variant. We don't know a lot about it. It's about 10% of the cases. It's called XBB 1.16, but we don't really know a lot about it. But as you've pointed out, in the hospital you're still seeing people who are very sick.
That's right. And it's, and these variants are going to continue to come out. If the same thing happens with lots of other viruses, we're just paying extra specially close attention, I think for obvious reasons, to what COVID is doing. Excuse me. This is mostly my allergies, I'm hoping. We're going to see more of these. And just like we saw new variants coming out a couple of years ago, as we were all scrutinizing this very closely, you would see one variant that is able to reproduce a little bit more efficiently and to be transmitted a little bit better very quickly in a matter of a few weeks, completely or near completely replace the previous predominant variant. And so we're gonna see new ones all the time.
How has the medical scene changed locally here, staffing wise? We talked over the course of the pandemic that there was really an issue with healthcare providers in our hospitals where we're actually having to bring nursing staff in from the outside. Have things, at least where you're working, have they stabilized a little bit, Matt Hines?
We've had effectively in Arizona and Southern Arizona, specifically Pima County, we've had a nursing shortage and in general a healthcare provider shortage, depending on how you want to, which subsection of healthcare providers you want to look at, for decades. The pandemic did not help that. And I would say we are still struggling with that shortage now, because in not just my facility, but in lots of our facilities across the county, emergency departments especially are having to heavily rely on agency or traveling nurses. Very, very expensive resource, unfortunately. And that, Banner has had to deal with that. Same thing with Northwest, with my facility. All of us are dealing with that. So we haven't fixed the staffing crisis. And I hope that that's something that we can continue to work on.
Let's talk now about the Board of Supervisors, the call to audience, letting the public speak. A woman who was banned by the board from the meetings for making remarks made against you, Dr. Matt Hines, during the call to the public, is now allowed to return. I don't know if she has been at any of the meetings since this happened. How's it going?
Yep. She came last Tuesday, and she didn't issue the same somewhat slanderous remarks that she had before. And I believe she was banned for, I think, 90 days, and we all voted unanimously to allow her back about a month earlier. So I think is how that went down. It's getting longer, and people are very, very agitated, and so there's a lot of anger, and I'm not real sure that this is the best forum or the most constructive way to be moving forward here. But and it's also, again, it's a lot of folks being encouraged to go by the GOP county chair, who comes every meeting to scream at us about something as well. but it's not very often any specific policy. It really isn't. It's very, it's just a series of these diatribes, monologues about, you know, in some cases, COVID vaccine requirements, which haven't been something that the county's done for a year and a half or more, right? So it's not really, it is what it is. I do think we need to work on making sure that the county government can run efficiently and that these meetings are there for folks who are looking to speak at a rezoning hearing, for example. They shouldn't have to wait 4.5 hours with two of them being occupied by this kind of discourse. I hope that we can come together as a board and decide on some rules, behavior, and maybe some changes in the way, you know, where in the meeting this occurs, how much time people can speak. By the way, the city of Tucson has a time certain cap of 30 minutes. And
really?
As you know, yes. And if they don't get to all of their speaker cards, they put them like up next. I mean, they're meeting every week as opposed to twice a month, but they are the first people to speak at the next time, and they have staff reach out in the interim. But it's time certain, 30 minutes. And I would love to see something like that. I don't know that there are three votes to do that. Maybe it'd have to be 60 minutes or something. But we do have to run the government, and there are some very important issues we're talking about. Title 42 is coming to a close. That public health with the public health crisis with regard to COVID, May 11th, and we're going to see a huge influx of folks. And the county is basically running a federal program, and getting reimbursed by the feds for doing it. It's important work, and we have to do that. These people need temporary shelter and screening and food and such. And it's safest for them. It's safest for our community. But these are the kinds of things we need to be figuring out. And it's important to be able to focus on the work ahead of us.
And before we take the break, what is the time? What are the constraints right now? What are the ground rules as of right now? If someone wants to come and speak at a board meeting, a Pima County Supervisors meeting,
anyone is welcome. And excuse me, currently they get 3 minutes. And the rules, which many choose not to follow, are read by the chair, by Chair Grijalva, ahead of time, and just some basic, behavioral, don't interrupt a speaker that's talking if it's not your turn, and don't shout or distract or disrupt the meeting if you do. These are the kinds of, and I don't have the paragraph sitting in front of me, but basically rules of civility type stuff. And again, a lot of folks choose not to do that. A great example, this last meeting, a woman came to thank Supervisor Scott for writing a very nice guest opinion in the Sentinel with regard to Cattle in the Foothills' support of transgender students. And she is the mother of a transgender student. And as she was trying to speak initially before she thanked Rex Scott, she wanted to say something to me, which was that she was saddened to see the amount of unfortunately, a lot of hate speak and a lot of anger directed toward me for, I think, no real reason. And she mentioned that and was immediately, there was so much shouting, we couldn't hear her anymore.
What?
She was terrified. She'd never, to my knowledge, I've never seen her at a meeting before. And this is the thing that I was talking about with you before. People that don't ever go to these meetings but have one issue. She wanted to read a short statement that her child wrote to Rex Scott to thank him for speaking out for transgender youth. And this woman was just shouted down. The chair had to restart her time and admonish the crowd to please respect everyone's wishes to speak. And it's this is not acceptable. And then afterwards, one of the folks that was shouting her down confronted her just outside the board meeting room, and an altercation nearly happened, requiring our security services to respond. So this is exactly what I'm talking about, and we shouldn't be waiting until people get into fist fights or someone gets very seriously injured before we try to bring this under some responsible level of control.
Oh, boy. All right, let's take a pause right here. We'll have a few more minutes with Dr. Matt Hines after we take a break.
Noble Hops is Tucson's original gastropub, serving an ever-changing menu of craft beer and fine fare. Savor the majestic mountain views from the perfect for any season spacious patio at West Lambert Lane and North La Cañada Drive in Oro Valley. Order in or take out at Noble Hops, a pub for foodies. On the web at noblehops.com. For more than a half century, Tucson Gardeners Trust Green Things, a family-owned and operated retail and wholesale plant nursery, offering an amazing variety of plants, trees, cacti, pottery, and so much more, all at great prices. The 13.5-acre site by the Rito River is also home to the Zocalo Village, specializing in fine Mexican and Latin American imported furniture and art. Green Things open daily at 3384 East River Road and at greenthingsaz.com and zocalovillage.com.
At Tucson International Airport, we are nonstop for our community. Our main priorities are providing a safe and secure travel experience and excellent customer service. We are also nonstop for landing prosperity in Southern Arizona by attracting new flights for business travel and family getaways. When your airport thrives, our community thrives. So fly local, fly TUS. Tucson International Airport is nonstop for Tucson.
The nonprofit Tucson Wildlife Center has been helping injured, sick, and orphan wildlife in Southern Arizona since 1999. They're dedicated to the rescue, medical care, and rehabilitation of sick, injured, and orphan wildlife, with the goal of releasing them back to their natural habitat. Around 5,000 animals a year come to them, as they are the only wildlife rescue in Southern Arizona. All made possible through donations. They receive no government funding. Please donate at TucsonWildlife.com. The Regional Transportation Authority plan is funded by a voter-approved half-cent sales tax. The RTA tax is collected throughout Pima County and averages about $100 million in revenue each month. The RTA is the largest annual funder of regional transportation projects in the region. The RTA tax funds priority projects that were approved by voters in 2006. See details in the latest RTA annual report at rtamobility.com. Nestled in the foothills of the Santa Rita Mountains of southeastern Arizona is Equine Voices and Sanctuary, home to horses and burros that were rescued from neglect, abuse, abandonment, and slaughter. Please consider Equine Voices Rescue and Sanctuary with a financial gift of support and estate remembrance. Learn more about our vision and values at equinevoices.org.
This is John Trout. Catch me every weekday morning at 5 before Wake Up Tucson with America in the Morning. Breaking news, weather, politics, and sports on 1030 KVOI, The Voice.
Welcome back. It is the Buckmaster Show on this Monday afternoon, beautiful afternoon here in Tucson. I want to talk a little bit about Silver City in Grant County, New Mexico. This Memorial Day weekend coming up before you know it. On Saturday, May 27th, that's Memorial Day weekend over in Silver City, they have their annual Silver City Blues Festival. This is a free blues festival featuring the brightest rising stars of blues, as well as classic season performers who have toured the world. So this is a great event coming up, only about a three-hour drive east of Tucson to Silver City, New Mexico. We send a lot of our listeners to that beautiful area of the Land of Enchantment. Their website is southwestnewmexico.org for information about what to do. There's a lot to do over there, where to stay, some great places to stay as well. Let's continue now with District 2 Democrat Dr. Matt Hines sits on the five-member board of the Pima County Board of Supervisors. You mentioned Dr. Hines in our first segment. Title 42 is expiring in May, just really a few days away now. What is the end of Title 42 going to mean for Pima County?
So, and just to clarify for your listeners, this is a public health provision of the federal code, and this is something that was used to basically keep any folks coming across the border who are seeking asylum, who are there are five different categories of reasons they can seek asylum, of course, discrimination based on gender, a variety of other things, religion. And so for those presenting themselves to a port of entry, a border, for example, they could, prior to the pandemic, they could come in and then be situated with a family member in the country while their claim of asylum, the request for asylum was adjudicated. Sometimes it could take a year, year and a half, sometimes two. Title 42, due to the pandemic, the public health crisis, was used by the past administration, by the Trump administration, to basically say, we are not going to admit anyone seeking asylum. And so a lot of folks that are asylum seekers, illegal status, by the way, at the board meeting regularly, people are using incorrect terminology. This is a legal status. And in some cases, these folks can even work here temporarily while their case is being decided. We are seeing in Pima County about 700 folks per day that are being delivered here to the county. And they, on average, stay about 72 hours. Some that have health issues maybe have to stay a little bit longer. There are health screenings and, of course, food and shelter provided. Pima County has stood up several facilities, and we have contracts with multiple hotels and motels for asylum seekers who are as a member of a family unit. And then for individual males, adult males, that is a different facility on Drexel. It has a capacity of about 400. And we're expecting that number 700, starting probably immediately after May 11th, to balloon at least double, probably to 1,400 or 1,500, at least temporarily, because there's a pent up, you know, there's a lot of folks that have been told, no, you have to stay south of the border, basically. And that's going to increase for, I don't know if it's going to be a few months or if it's going to be for most of the year. And we are prepared for that. Of course, this is a federal, the county is essentially navigating and executing a federal program on behalf of the federal government, for which we are fronting considerable amounts of dollars, county tax dollars, that then get reimbursed to us by the feds, I believe now on a quarterly basis. We're hoping they will be willing to do annual going forward, because, I mean, we're doing a good job at it. We're anticipating this need, and we're ready.
So you think that the county will be able to handle, I think you said, up to 1,500 people per day?
That's right. And just to also to remind you and viewers, not every single person or family has to stay. There's a large welcome center, and some folks have, you know, already have like a bus ticket or a flight ready to go and for that day. And so they aren't going to the Drexel Center. They aren't going to a hotel or motel, you know, on the federal dime that's, you know, by way of Pima County. They're actually like, they have a short, quick little landing pad for a few hours, and they're out the same day. But then there are, you know, hundreds of others who do need 1 to 3 days, maybe a little more. The average, again, is 72 hours that individuals stay in Pima County before they go on to family in Iowa or you know, they get on a Greyhound or go to somewhere in California or Texas or wherever they're going to be waiting out the adjudication process for their particular case.
But so far, that facility on West Drexel Road near I-10, which has been up and running now a little, well, about a month and a half, it's doing okay?
That's right. Yeah, it is. And we are, in anticipation of this increase in need, it is right now it's ready to go for 400 beds, I believe. But if we can expand that, even if it's just temporarily, to accommodate some additional volume, just temporarily, that's something that we're looking at as well.
Okay, Dr. Matt Hines, thank you for joining us. Are you sensitive, like many people, to all of the Palo Verdes? I heard you saying you were hoping allergies. You're hoping it's allergies.
Yeah, I'm on like three or four different allergy things right now, you know, the nasal sprays and the Claritins and whatnot. And it helps, but you can kind of still tell I'm a little congested.
You betcha. All right, Dr. Hines, thanks for spending some time with us, and we'll catch up with you next time.
Of course. Thank you, Bill.
All right. That's going to do it. On behalf of Dr. Matt Hines, our interview, and John, engineering and producing the show, Bill Buckmaster, urging you to stick around after the CBS Network News. Always entertaining, that Dave Ramsey show talking about your money. That's coming up here on KVOI. Have a great afternoon, everybody.